Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls with Mark Thompson as we talk about things in our solar system, things going on in space. His book is called A Space Traveler's Guide to the Solar System. So let's get your calls ready to go when we come right back. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, back with our scientist, Mark Thompson. Mark, as we're talking about the sun, that it should have a life of another 5 billion years, but the question was, can anything happen? Can anything go wrong to speed that up?
Yeah, there's one of the things we do understand quite well in the universe is the evolutionary process of stars. Because I was saying, if you wander around a forest or wooded area, you look at all the trees, you don't need to stand there and watch a tree grow, live, and then die to understand how trees live. So all you need to do is you look around, you sample all the trees that are there, you see some little ones, you see some really big ones, you see some dead ones, and you can infer lots about the evolutionary process of the tree. And in the same way, we can study all the different thousands and thousands of millions of stars in the sky, and we can learn about how stars evolve. So actually, we understand fairly well how stars do evolve, how they do live, how they do die. So we would be, I would be pretty surprised if we suddenly found that something was wrong and that we got it all wrong and actually something happened to speed the process up. So I don't think that's likely to happen. I'd be pretty surprised by that.
Let's hope. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. Huh? I just love the marvels of space. And we were talking about earlier the technologies that we could have. Stephen Hawking, talking about an expert in things, has warned us to be very careful about letting the universe know where we are and who we are. He's concerned about that. Is that justifiable?
It's a fascinating idea, isn't it? And actually, even by doing what we're doing right now, by talking on the radio, we are unwittingly transmitting our existence and making potential civilizations out there aware that we're here. So every time all the radio transmissions that we, the human beings, have been producing have been slowly drifting out into space. So all the stars around us, the stars in our region of the galaxy, will be picking up, not this station, because that will take a little time for the signal to get there, but all the radio transmissions that we've been producing over the last sort of 50 to 100 years will slowly be sort of drifting out in a sphere, an ever-growing sphere that surrounds the Earth. So there are star systems that will have received some of our earliest radio communications. So if there are civilizations around the nearby stars, they may well know that we're here anyway. Should we be worried about it? It's a difficult thing, isn't it? If you look at human beings, how do we respond to other races that we may have found? If we come across a tribe in the Amazon rainforest, for example, that's never knew about and that's never really interacted with, let's say, modern humans before, how would we react? How would they react? Would we necessarily want to wipe them out? I like to think we're beyond that. I like to think that we've got to a level of perhaps psychological evolution. I don't know if that's a thing, but let's call it psychological evolution, where actually if we find a species such as an alien civilization who are much more advanced than us find us, and we could be quite primitive, I'd like to think that they'd have reached a level of evolution that they wouldn't just want to wipe us out and take over the planet, that actually what they'd want to do is either just watch and leave us to get on with our own thing, or even better than that, come and talk to us and help us and teach us. Do I think Stephen Hawking is right to be concerned by it? I'm more of an optimistic, let's say, so I think I would be less concerned about it. I think I would take the optimistic view. Actually, they would be nice, less like Darth Vader, and actually try and help us up the foot of the ladder.
Let me ask you this. What is your understanding of the Big Bang?
Okay, so it's a good question. If we study the things that we can see in the sky, if we look at all the galaxies that we can see in the sky, then for the most part, there are billions of galaxies in the night sky that we can observe. For the most part, there's only literally a handful of galaxies, maybe 20 or so. But if we look at all the other galaxies, all the billions of galaxies that we can see in the night sky, then they all seem to be rushing away from us. So that either means that we've kind of got some cosmic condition of body odor, and everyone's trying, or we're just really horrible, and everyone, all the galaxy is trying to race away from us. Or actually, it's because the universe is expanding. Now, if you imagine a balloon, or in fact, a balloon's a good example. If you imagine a balloon with some dots on the surface, as you blow the balloon up, all of the dots will seem to move away from all of the other dots. It doesn't mean that any of those dots are in the center of the balloon. It just means that space, the rubble of the balloon is expanding. So if we were, if our galaxies were on the balloon, which would in fact turn out to be the fabric of space, then the fabric of space is expanding and carrying all the galaxies away from each other. Now, if you take that backwards in time, if you measure the speed, the velocity of the expansion, and how fast those galaxies are rushing away, then conceivably, we can work out at what point in time all of the galaxies would have been at the same point in space. And if we do that, apply some sums to the velocity of the galaxies we can measure, then it turns out that 13.7 billion years ago, all of those galaxies would have been in the same region of the universe and occupying the same space. So the only conclusion from that really is, or certainly the most plausible conclusion, is that something, or the universe started where everything was in one place and it suddenly expanded out. So therefore, you know, we have this concept of an explosion, this concept of the Big Bang, which was the moment of creation of our universe.
It is puzzling, though, Mark, isn't it?
In what sense puzzling?
Well, for me it is, because, again, I think of nothingness.
Yes.
Coming from, you know, and then something from nothing. That, yes, I have a difficult time with.
Yeah, so I see where you're coming from. So where did the Big Bang come from? That's the $6 million question. And I think that's probably one of the questions in science that we may well never know the answer to. And you're absolutely right. If we look at all the many theories that suggest that where the Big Bang came from, one of them simply is that because space and time are related, then, and we can see space and time are related, because space and time are related, if space was created in the Big Bang, then time itself would have been created in the Big Bang. So therefore, there would be no space and no time before the Big Bang. And that's hard to get your head around, but there's a wonderful analogy. If you took a walk to the North Pole and you followed your compass heading north, and you get to a point where you reach the North Pole, there's nowhere further north than the North Pole. Doesn't mean that it's any sort of surreal thing. It just means that you are at the most northerly point. And equally, you know, you may be able to map that concept to the Big Bang, and so you go back in time so far until you get to a point where actually there was nothing before. But as humans, we have to have this in our heads. We have this really niggly, annoying thing, which is sort of cause and effect. If there's a Big Bang, then something would have caused that. But actually, maybe there wasn't something that caused the Big Bang. Maybe it just happened. And that's difficult. So, yeah, very, 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 and yes, you're right. That bit of it is very, very puzzling.
It sure is. Let's go to the phones now. We'll go to Buck on the wild card line in Limestone, West Virginia. I just heard you on a Coast Insider promo.
Hey, that's right there, George. Good morning. And you're absolutely right. There's no way possible anyone could enjoy being an insider more than me.
That's true. You're one of a kind, my friend.
Let me just say one thing real quick. I saw this on the internet a while back, and that is more alien civilizations listen to Coast to Coast than all other transmissions combined.
Okay.
But anyway, my question for Mark is, theoretically speaking, what does he think would be the shortest time we may have to react to a real terrible asteroid strike? And if we do we have the technology to avert that?
So, I mean, that's a fabulous question. We've all seen the films, the Hollywood blockbuster films, where, you know, good old Bruce Willis saved the day. The reality is slightly more scary, unfortunately, because if an asteroid is heading towards us currently, we don't have the ability to do anything about it. So whether we discover it now and it's something that's going to hit us tomorrow, or whether we discover it tomorrow and it's going to hit us in 100 years' time, at the moment we do not have any technology and no proven way of deflecting an asteroid that's heading straight for us. That said, I would add that, you know, we know of no asteroids that are going to head straight for us. But the the other aspects of the question of how long and how much notice would we need, it depends on so many different things. It depends on the direction of travel of the asteroid, whether it's going to be a sort of a potential head-on collision, whether it's going to be something that's going to sort of sneak up behind us and get us from behind, whether it's a very massive object, what the object's made of, is it mostly made of sort of heavy metals, or is it made of rock and minerals? So there's lots of different angles. So the sort of the answer about how much notice we might need or get is very difficult. It's how long is a piece of string? But if we ever do find anything that's heading straight for us and we know it's going to hit us, at the moment there's nothing we can do at all.
No,
because I'm afraid, but I say no.
Even trying to blow it up could create a bigger problem.
It could, it could certainly create a bigger problem, but and it would produce more fragments. But those extra fragments, if they're small enough, could burn up in the atmosphere. And we see rocks burn up in the atmosphere.
Right.
All the time through this thing we call shooting stars, actually pieces of rock that are burning up in the atmosphere.
And they're really little dinky pieces, though, aren't
they're
they?
They're normally little dinky pieces, and certainly if they're really, really big, then they will get through the atmosphere. Absolutely. And we saw that, there's evidence of the Tunguska asteroid that exploded in midair. There's another in Chelyabinsk in Russia a couple of years back. So absolutely, there's evidence of bigger chunks of rock landing. But if we do try and blow it up, then yes, it will produce more chunks of rock if we succeed, that is, in blowing it up. Chances are they're not going to be small enough to burn up in the atmosphere. It may deflect them enough to cause them to miss, but if not, then it could actually produce more widespread devastation than just one piece of rock hitting somewhere.
Let's go to Henry in North Hollywood, California now. Henry, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Before my mother passed away, she was also a Coast to Coast subscriber.
Oh.
Put that in. So she really enjoyed that as she departed from this world with cancer this year.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that for you.
I'm curious about Niku, and you were wondering about a place that you would want to go. I would want to go to Niku.
Now, where is Niku?
I heard that this is one of the new dwarf planets that's orbiting actually in a solar orbit.
Okay.
So then, is there anything? Maybe I misread the story, but I really thought it was Niku the Challenger, and that is a Chinese word. And it's these polar orbit dwarf planets.
Well, we do have dwarf planets, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. We do have dwarf planets. And and whether something is a dwarf planet or not is just simply determined by logistics, the nature of the object and the orbit of the object. Pluto, of course, you may remember a couple of years back, was demoted from being a planet and made into a dwarf planet. By nature of the fact that it shares its orbit with its moon called Charon, which is significantly large in comparison to Pluto. There are thousands, conceivably maybe even millions, of dwarf planets in orbit around the Sun. And typically, these things are maybe smaller than the moon, but, they are lumps of rock. Whether a dwarf planet would be a good place to go to, because they're generally small by nature of the fact that we class them as a dwarf planet, then they're unlikely to have much of an atmosphere. So normally a planet needs to be of decent size to have enough gravity to hold on to enough gas to give it an atmosphere. So, dwarf planets wouldn't have much of an atmosphere. So if you did go there, then, you might feel a bit lighter because of the lesser pull of gravity, but you wouldn't be able to take your space helmet off and have a good breath of fresh air, unfortunately.
I haven't heard of that name, though. Have you, Nico?
No.
I haven't heard that
before.
John in Alabama.
It's in a polar orbit, did you say?
Yeah. John in Alabama. Go ahead, John.
Hello. I was wondering, when you're looking at a star pattern like Orion, you see the three stars that make up the belt of Orion. How far apart are those from each other in the vast expanse?
Oh, that's a neat question. Millions.
That's a great question because actually constellations are, if you like, man-made things. So the stars that are in the sky at vastly different distances. So the nearest star is just over 4 light years away. The most distant star that you could see with the naked eye, crikey, that's probably going to be of the order of a few, probably a couple of hundred light years away, maybe even 1,000 or so light years away that you can see with the naked eye. And constellations such as Orion, the stars are all at vastly different distances in many cases. It's just that there's the line of sight between them, so that from here on Earth they look like they're in a line, you're quite right, but the stars of Orion are actually separated by 1,000 light years or so, so quite significant distances between them. But of course they look like they're in the same distance as here on Earth.
How'd there get to be so many stars in the universe, Mark? I mean, zillions of them.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, star formations. Like, I mean, how come there's so many trees in the forest? It's just that the right material is there. When the universe formed in the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, the universe was seeded with vast amounts of hydrogen gas. Now, hydrogen gas, when it accumulates under the force of, well, under the electrostatic force initially, but then the force of gravity, will form stars. So if you have hydrogen gas, you will have stars form over millions of years. And, you know, the universe is a big place, so plenty of stars are formed.
I've asked physicists about the expanding universe theory, and they always tell me the universe is like a balloon. And when a balloon expands, that's how the universe is expanding. But then I say, well, yeah, but that balloon is expanding into something that's outside of it. I don't get it with the universe, and they can't explain that to me.
One of the challenges that we have is that our feeble minds, our human brains, are not very good at visualizing complex mathematical concepts. And that's one of the difficulties. You know, we talk of a universe now that's got up to 11 dimensions. So you and me, we perceive the three spatial dimensions, you know, of height, width, and depth, if you like. Add in the dimension of time, then we can kind of perceive four dimensions in the universe. But current theories are predicting 11 dimensions in the universe. And we can't visualize that. Our brains will not be able to visualize that. Don't try and visualize it.
You can't. You'll go crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and equally, trying to understand what the universe is expanding into, if indeed it's expanding into anything, then you'll go mad, because mathematically it doesn't expand into anything. It just is.
If Einstein were alive today, Mark, and had the ability to use personal computers, what do you think he'd be coming up with in terms of his thoughts and theories?
Wow, if he would probably have cracked a lot of the problems in modern physics, I would imagine.
I think so too, because he did all this on a chalkboard, for crying out loud.
Yeah, but you know, I think actually the most powerful tool that human beings have is the human brain, because you've only got to look back to and look back at a lot of the major discoveries in science, and they didn't really benefit from a computer. So Eratosthenes in 2 BC worked out, pretty approximately, but he was not far off, he worked out the circumference of the Earth. And he did that by studying shadows on the surface of the Earth.
And mathematics. Of course, Einstein would probably say, how do you send a text message? Somebody help me here.
Anyway, yeah, of course he would. He wouldn't have a clue, would he? and really, all a computer would do would give him the ability to compute stuff quicker. But the really powerful thing is what's in their mind.
What's in his head?
The human ingenuity that they can come up with the questions to try and answer.
Mark, we're going to come back in just a moment with final questions for you. Thank you so much for being with us. Mark Thompson will come back and take your final calls next. Mark Thompson with us, his book, A Space Traveler's Guide to the Solar System. We're going to come back in a moment and take final calls with him. Okay, welcome back to our final segment. Mark Thompson with us, of course. And so, Mark, what does your day consist of these days in terms of working in space stuff?
Well, my days these days are just wrapped up with media work, which is wonderful, because that was always my dream job as a lad, aside from being an astronaut, of course. So it's a mixture of wonderful sessions like this, talking on radio, writing articles for websites, writing for magazines, doing television work. But I'm also in the process of touring a science theatre show around UK theatres at the moment. So it's a fairly mixed bag, but it consists of lots of travelling and lots of talking about space, which is perfect.
We've got an old friend in the United Kingdom who's just an amazing author and storyteller. I don't know if you know his name, Lionel Fanthorpe. Do you know him by any chance, Mark?
The name is vaguely familiar.
He's done some television, but he writes on mysteries and things like that. But he's got this great big voice, and he's just a great storyteller.
It's a name that's vaguely familiar, certainly.
Super. Let's go take some final calls here for you. Lynn is with us, first-time caller, Kansas City, Missouri. Lynn, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are y'all doing?
Great. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you.
Have you all heard of the connection between aliens and being Rh-negative blood?
I've heard that. I'm not sure you have, Mark.
No, that's a new one on me. You have to explain that one to me.
Well, I didn't know I was Rh negative till 40 years ago when I had a miscarriage. And the doctor told my husband and I that they found that I was Rh negative. My husband's positive.
Which is very rare on your end.
Yeah. Well, only 15% of the world's population is Rh negative. And it's really interesting because I've done quite a bit of reading on this, and I don't quite understand everything I know.
You're a reptilian, Lynn.
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah.
You might be.
But they said that a lot of the English royal family is Rh negative, and yeah, also a lot of the presidents are Rh negative. And, I mean, you think about it, 15% of the world's population, that's not very many people. And it has something to do with an antigen that they don't know where it came from. They do know it didn't come from this planet. They do know that. And they're still doing a lot of research on it.
As a matter of fact, I want you to call in again, if you can, on our next guest tonight, Lynn, because we're dealing with subjects like that. Mark, you're not a ufologist.
No, I'm not, but it's still interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's a couple of things there. So first of all, you know, you say that the rhesus negative is a sign of aliens, and that
it's a theory. It's a theory. Yeah.
Some of the chemicals are not from Earth, but it's interesting because actually, probably nearly all of the organic compounds which are the basic building blocks of life, we think came from comets. So actually, you know, you could argue that we're all aliens because none
That's
of
right.
the compounds which have made human beings are natural to the Earth. They've been brought here on comets. So it's just, you know, it's an interesting angle that perhaps all of our key compounds are from elsewhere in the solar system. But also, you know, if life has evolved elsewhere, then it's perfectly plausible that, you know, we've evolved over many years, hundreds of thousands of years, we've evolved with what we would consider to be a fairly efficient design for our bodies. You know, we've got legs so we can walk, which gives our hands freedom to operate tools and whatnot.
Eyes, ears, nose, everything.
Sorry?
Eyes, ears, nose,
yeah,
we've got them all.
Absolutely. And our eyes happen to operate within the sort of the peak frequency of the energy output of the sun, so our eyes can see visible light because that's the most prominent part that's coming away from the sun. So it's interesting that actually if life has evolved elsewhere in the universe, then there's a very good chance that it would also develop the most efficient form of body, and plausibly would look very much like us. So, yeah, I mean, there's it's a reasonable thing to suggest, you know, if there's 15% of the population with an extra, the negative, recent negative blood, you know, yeah, it's feasible that maybe they did come from elsewhere.
The Hubble Space Telescope, when it took that picture of the deep field, no bigger than a size of a dime, showed thousands of other galaxies, not stars, but galaxies, each possessing millions of stars themselves. I found that picture, Mark, to be absolutely astounding.
Yeah, it was a picture that was utterly mind-blowing. So the Hubble Space Telescope pointed at the same piece of sky, which you say is no bigger than a dime if you hold it at arm's length, the same patch of sky effectively for 10 solid days, and it captured thousands upon thousands of galaxies. And every one of those galaxies has got, on average, between sort of 300 and 400 billion stars. And we have every reason to believe that if you were to hold that dime up against different parts of the sky, then you would see more thousands and thousands of galaxies, all with 300 to 400 billion stars on average. So the number, I mean, there's a wonderful saying that there are more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on Earth. And you know, that puts into perspective how many stars are in the universe. And you know, you consider the question about life in the universe, then the chances that there's just one planet out there which has got life, I think, is so incredibly high. But potentially, it's going to be so far away from us that we never have a hope of actually the traveling there. You know, if it's at the other side of the universe, then it takes billions of years to get there, even at the speed of light. And so, you know, so there's all these different sort of issues and challenges that we'd have to meet.
When do we harness the ability to travel throughout space with this incredible kind of space warp time continuum traveling?
Wonderful, wouldn't it? You know, there's a really annoying law of physics which basically says the faster you go, the more massive you become. And if you approach the speed of light, then you become infinitely massive. So if you become infinitely massive, it then takes, because obviously the heavier you are, if you try and push a small box up a hill, then it takes less energy. If you try and push a really heavy box up a hill, it takes a lot more energy. And so if you travel fast, and travel faster and faster and faster, you get more and more massive, and it takes more and more energy to accelerate you even faster. So to be able to travel at the speed of light means you would actually need an infinite amount of energy to be able to accelerate you. So there's this annoying law of physics that says actually you can't travel at the speed of light because it would take an infinite amount of energy, and the universe doesn't have an infinite amount of energy. But there's nothing in science that says you can't travel faster than the speed of light. The challenge is getting to that speed before.
Exactly.
You've got to kind of go through the speed of light to get to faster than the speed of light, unless we can maybe harness the power of quantum tunneling, which is a sort of new brand of physics, which may enable us to reach such speeds. But it's in the long distant future, I think. Sadly.
We've got Mark in Fresno, California now. Mark, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, George. Mark.
Sure. Hi.
Now, could... I can't believe no one's called in Friday or Saturday. I've never seen it in the sky over 50 years. I like to watch planes and whatnot. But can you make out the shape of a satellite, two satellites, other than being round, but actually have like a ship shape with the naked eye?
That's an interesting question. I don't think you can, Mark. I don't think you can see the shape that far, can you?
You certainly wouldn't. The human eye doesn't have the visual acuity, the ability to define or to be able to sort of to determine shape on objects which are so far away from us. So satellites, the space station is really big, it's really bright in the sky, but you would never, with the human eye, without any optical aid, you'd never be able to see what the space station looked like unless you used a telescope or binoculars, in fact, a telescope, to be able to see the shape. So no, with the human eye, I would, unless someone's got superhuman eyesight, then I don't believe anybody would be able to see the shape of a satellite in orbit around the Earth from the surface of the Earth.
Let's go to Don in Salem, Oregon now, west of the Rockies. Don, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi there.
First off, George, as a Marine Corps veteran, I'd like to offer a salute to all the veterans past and present.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, Mark, I'd like your opinion on the possibility of life in underwater lakes on Mars. And thank you, gentlemen.
All right. Underground lakes on Mars. What do you think?
Well, so... We know that there's water locked up in the subsurface of Mars, so we can look at we've had spacecraft, we've had rovers trundle around the surface of the planet for many years now, excuse me, and we found evidence for what we call permafrost, which is sort of the ice locked up in the rocks. There's no evidence that I'm aware of any liquid oceans under the surface of Mars. There is evidence of liquid oceans under some of the moons in the outer solar system, such as Europa, as we talked about earlier, and I think there's more likely to be the discovery of some form of life, be it primitive, but some form of life on those outer moons than there is on Mars.
You wouldn't be surprised, though, if there was some kind of life on Mars, maybe in the form of insects. Would that baffle you?
Insects would baffle me. Anything that was more, so anything more primitive, bacteria, or, you know, like germs in quotes, then I think I would probably be surprised if we found signs of life, albeit primitive, on Mars today. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if we found evidence of primitive life on Mars at some point in the past. So we find some kind of records locked up, or evidence locked up in the rocks on Mars, rather than stuff crawling around the surface today.
Next up, Michael's in Vancouver in Canada. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, I have a couple questions for your guest.
Okay.
The first one for you to try to explain for us and the audience about this concept I heard of a few years ago, and my second question is a bit more important, I think, related to that concept. Years ago, I heard that, or read somewhere, that the galaxies are structured and laid out through the universe in sort of like a three-dimensional spider's web. Have you heard of that? And is that pretty well proven?
So, is it well proven?
Go ahead. You with us, Mark?
Absolutely. So, yeah, so we can detect, we can observe many things, but it's just by studying the light from distant stars and distant galaxies, we can determine the speed, and therefore we can work out the distance to all these different galaxies. And certainly if we map out the three-dimensional shape of the unit, or the three-dimensional position of all of those galaxies, yes, they do indeed kind of form a sort of a spider's web, where you've got these great chains of galaxies all connected, probably by the force of gravity holding them in that shape.
Strange. And you had another question, Michael?
In other words, with a vast amount of space in between, that seems to be just space. Is that right?
Well, yeah, they would certainly seem to be space, but then you've got to throw into the mix this thing called dark matter, which is material in the universe which we know is there, but we can't directly observe. So we know, and we can detect it in galaxies, in galaxy clusters, where its presence is given away by the effect it has on light, and it bends light in the same way that normal matter bends light. So we can see that it's there, but we can't directly detect it. So it may be that the empty space in between these vast chains of galaxies may well be full of dark matter, but at the moment we don't know.
Exactly. I'm an amateur astronomer, astrophysics. It's not my main profession, but I tend to sometimes have a hard time getting to sleep, so I visualize the universe. I'm very good at visualization dimensionally because I'm an inventor, and the moment I try to put an invention on paper, I'm not as creative. So when I heard that, it took me a little while of imagining, and it came to the conclusion, which you seem to imply, that is it possible that the dark matter and dark energy, one or the other or both, may be likened to, I'll use an analogy or metaphor, a sink or a basin where you mix in soap with water and you've got all these bubbles. You know, bubbles have air pressure inside. That's what keeps them separated with space in between, right? So if you visualize the edges of the bubbles where they bump up against the other ones, sort of like a three-dimensional honeycomb in a beehive, and they're also expanding and pushing away, and they're pushing the strings of the three-dimensional spider's web into these long strings. As the universe is expanding, is that possible that pressure, it's like air pressure, is pushing these webs apart and away from each other, and the whole universe is expanding that same way?
It's certainly possible, and it's interesting you mentioned dark energy, because I think I mentioned earlier dark matter and dark energy are two things that we can observe, we can detect, but we can't observe, and we don't know what they are. We've got theories, but we don't know what they are. But dark energy is one of the things that we think is driving the accelerated expansion of the universe. So a discovery was made a few years back that the universe isn't just expanding either a constant rate or it's a decelerating rate. That actually, the universe is expanding faster now than it ever was before. And one of the theories is that dark energy, which is an energy which is kind of permeating the entire universe, is causing and forcing the acceleration, so the expansion, to accelerate faster. And absolutely, it's quite plausible that has something to do with the large scale structure of the universe, with the large walls, if you like, or chains of galaxies that we can see.
It's exciting work, Mark. What's next on your plate? What happens in the future?
Well, next thing on my plate is Christmas. I've just finished touring a new science show around theatres in the UK called Spectacular Science, where I just do an hour of crazy science experiments, which families and kids are loving. So I've got some new TV shows lined up for the UK in the new year. So and some more books as well, of course, working on a couple more books.
If you could get an answer to this one baffling question out there in the universe, what would the question be, and what do you think the answer could be?
There are so many questions that I would love to ask, and I really struggle to choose one, but it would have to be about alien life and are we alone in the universe. That would be the one that I would pick.
Yeah, that, and then I'd go for the Big Bang again.
Yes, that would be my number two as well.
How did something happen from nothingness? Now, the book, of course, where do we get it?
So it's called A Space Traveler's Guide to the Solar System. It's published by Pegasus out there in the U.S., and it is available now. All good bookshops have got it.
And Amazon.com, of course, right?
Absolutely, of course. Yep.
Mark, thank you. Have a great holiday with your family, and be safe, my friend, okay? Mark Thompson, wonderful person, great scientist, and a superb mind. Up next, though, things continue as we talk about alien civilization, scientific proof of their existence. So we're taking a different spin on something we've been talking about for some time. Will Hart joins me on Coast to Coast AM. And yes, later in the program as well, we will take your phone calls. Now also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We sent out a couple tweets today and some interesting news. And also like us on Facebook. Email me at George@coasttocoastam.com.